Welcome back. Linda Cohen here. Well, if you felt lethargic and dull while sitting in a packed auditorium, it may not be the speaker's fault at all. It might be actually something in the air. Well, here with me to discuss the results of a new study done jointly at Upstate Medical University and Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratories is Dr. Usha Satish, Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Upstate Medical University. She's joining me by phone. Welcome, Dr. Satish. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So what is this substance in the air that could be affecting us?
We were actually studying CO2, which is a naturally occurring substance in the air. And there are different levels of CO2 that are found. This is carbon dioxide that are found in the outside environment and in the inside environment. And our study was focusing on how these levels of carbon dioxide might impact people's thinking processes, specifically how we make decisions in our day-to-day world.
It's really a little shocking to me in the fact that carbon dioxide would be would have a negative impact on the way our brains function, since it's a naturally, as you said, naturally occurring. I mean, obviously, its more lethal cousin, carbon monoxide, obviously is well known to create problems. So tell us how you got this study organized and how you developed this collaboration and why.
Yes. I have been working for several years using a standardized methodology called the Strategic Management Simulation to assess people's decision-making skills and thinking skills in different realms. And parallelly, in the world of environmental studies, there has been a lot of emphasis placed on human productivity and human performance as it relates to different environmental toxins. And Dr. Bill Fisk, my collaborator in Berkeley, actually found me through this system called the Strategic Management Simulation. And we started talking, and I thought this was going to be really interesting to look at how people perform under these different conditions. And I was relatively new to the area at that time, and I found the whole world of understanding how people think quite fascinating as it relates to something as basic as how we breathe and where we breathe and so on. And I got interested and excited, and we began our collaboration a few years ago.
So you tested, I see, you used 24 individuals and tried to see if you decreased or increased the amount. Well, why don't you tell us exactly what you did?
Sort of a pilot project that we began, and just to give you a little bit of a background, normal CO2 that you would find, let's say if you're taking a walk outside in the open, would be approximately 380 parts per million. That's sort of the index by which they measure the amount of CO2 in the air. Inside an office with normal construction and so on, it would be approximately somewhere around 1,000 parts per million. There are, however, certain areas, for example, a closed elevator where there's lots of people, or classrooms which are packed with students, or meeting rooms, as you pointed out when you introduced the study, where you could see up to about 3,000 parts per million. And so we were curious to find out whether people's thinking patterns or how they feel in these environments are different. And so this is what we conducted, what they call a chamber study. In these studies, everything else is very well controlled. So you can actually study the impact of a particular component, which in this case was CO2. And so we used three levels of CO2 to see how that might impact decision making. We used 600 parts per million, 1,000 parts per million, and 2,500 parts per million.
So 600 parts per million would be the level that you might have in a well-ventilated room internally. I mean,
that's
an inside
correct
room.
But yeah,
when you got up to 1,000 or 2,500, you were already at more of an excessive level.
That's true. And so when we did our study, we found some very interesting results. At 600, we did not find any decrements in thinking skills. However, as we started moving up to 1,000 and then 2,500, there were significant decrements in certain areas of decision-making, such as the people's abilities to plan, how well they strategize, how you manage information, the ability you have to sort of focus on an overall goal or task. All these were impacted, and it's important to remember that these are decision-making parameters we all use in our day-to-day life. We just don't realize it, but these are kind of the underlying nuts and bolts of thinking that we bring to the table every day, whether we are doing something routine and simple or we are making complex decisions, both at home and at work.
So this could have a very significant impact, I would think, certainly in corporations, in government, or in any place where numbers of people would be together in a maybe a less well-ventilated setting trying to work and make decisions, such as you might find in a modern-day office building with a lot of people in a cubicle-type setting sharing one common space.
That would be correct, provided the study is replicated with larger numbers. As I said, this is kind of a pilot study, so we don't want to come to premature conclusions, but I would agree with you that if this study is replicated with larger samples and we continue to find these results, then you're absolutely correct. That would be the implication.
Tell us a little bit more about the strategic management simulation test that you used. What are the actual things that you asked people to do?
We put people in semi-simulated environments where they are asked to make different kinds of decisions. These exposures are basically to scenarios that people are somewhat familiar with, but not completely familiar with, and that is the best way to measure underlying process of thinking. And based on people's decisions, there are algorithms that actually calculate very complex measures of thinking, as we were talking about earlier, in terms of people's levels of initiative, their task orientation, their ability to focus on goals, how well they are able to think through and plan, how well they prioritize and strategize their actions. And again, these are all very simple functions, and yet we use it all the time in our day-to-day life.
Can you give us... I'm sorry, Dr. Satish, can you just give us an example of a question, for example, or a problem presented, just so we have a better feel for what people are actually being asked to do?
Sure. So, for example, you could be made in charge of a office, or you could be made in charge of a city. There are many, many scenarios, and these are all randomized. And so you kind of get to play the role of a decision maker. So let's say, for example, you are in charge of an entire county or a city. We will throw such challenging situations at you, such as a flood or a fire, and see how people deal with that. Again, we are not looking to see whether you are sending 10 fire trucks or one fire truck. We are actually looking to see how you're processing information. And this test has been validated for over 30 years and has been used quite extensively both in the corporate and in federal sectors to assess and train decision makers. So that would kind of be a scenario, and you would be given anywhere between 20 minutes and an hour, depending on which scenario we pick and the purpose of the simulation. And you will just keep making decisions for this period of time, and at the end of your performance, you will be given your feedback in terms of the decision-making profile.
So would you say that one of the criteria for judging, I'm not exactly clear in terms of the success or efficacy of the action, was the time it took to arrive at a decision, or was it just the absolute nature of the decision made?
So this is interesting. We are kind of getting into the nuts and bolts of the system itself. It's what is known as quasi-experimental simulation, and this was designed, as I said, several years ago. And what it does is it doesn't actually look at response time or reaction time. It actually looks at what are the first responses that emanate from your brain in terms of decision-making. Are you bringing to the table initiative? Are you bringing to the table an orientation to a particular task? And these are thinking styles, so we are all very different in the way we approach the problem. So we are actually looking much more at qualitative decision-making vis-a-vis the processes that you bring into bring to play, not necessarily the kind of decisions you make or the reaction time. We're looking at the process that you are bringing to play. So some people could be very skilled planners. Others could be very skilled strategists. But we all have sort of a norm, or a, there are norms that have been designed for normal people where we've established that most normal thinkers, unless there is some kind of external variable impacting your thinking, should have a certain level of planning, a certain level of strategy, a certain level of orientation, a certain level of initiative. And that's what we look at when we do our studies, to see how does this normal level change under different conditions.
So what is the hypothesis? Granted, this is only a pilot. Mm-hmm. But what would your hypothesis be in terms of the increasing amount of carbon dioxide in an environment, how that might have, I understand you're not an expert on CO2. I understand that's a Mr. Fisk's or Dr. Fisk's role. But what in your discussions have come up as some of the hypotheses as to what the effect of the carbon dioxide is on the thinking process?
So the federal occupation exposure guidelines for carbon dioxide concentrations as it sits today is about 5,000 parts per million for approximately 8 hours.
So that's a maximum exposure that anyone should have over time, over an entire eight-hour workday.
That's what the guidelines tell us today. So if this study is replicated and we find that people's thinking patterns and styles are being impacted, then obviously that would then imply that their decision-making could be impacted as well. And with that, there are implications for standards and codes, particularly when you think about schools. That's an area of interest that we have pursued as well. We'd like to obviously make sure that children get the best benefit of their education. So there are long-term implications in those areas.
Now, has some of this very, very, strong emphasis in recent years in terms of energy conservation has been in terms of, you know, the building codes and keeping things very tight, very well insulated. Do you think that's played a role in why we might be seeing higher parts per million in terms of carbon dioxide?
I wouldn't be able to answer that, but that is certainly a possibility. Again, we have not studied the SMS under those conditions, but overall, one could come to that conclusion.
So in the very little bit of time we have left, are you planning to do a larger sample size?
Yes.
Is that in the works?
We are hoping to actually pursue this work with more controls in place, exactly for, as you mentioned, for example, using perhaps some of the newer buildings to do our testing. And we are hoping to do this in the next couple of years.
Wonderful. Well, very interesting information, something we really should take note of. And clearly with the issue of having standards in schools and in office buildings and in government settings, we want everyone to be thinking clearly and making good decisions. So I want to thank you so much for coming in today. My guest has been Dr. Usha Satish, Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Upstate Medical University.